Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com. Hi, this is Matt, and you're listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who loves bluegrass. Hey, everybody, welcome back. This is going to be an interview with Matt Glazer of Berklee College of Music, and just wanted to give you a quick intro to explain kind of a bit of the context for this one. I saw Matt speak at IBMA last year. He gave the keynote speech and gave a wonderful, wonderful talk about how the roots of American music all sort of blend together. So we'll talk kind of in the interview about that, and then you'll hear us talking about the IBMA talk, and that's what it is. So if it's not obvious from the interview, it was so interesting. And, you know, for a while I wanted to talk to Matt about it, but it felt like he'd given this wonderful talk with lots of musical examples, and we couldn't really replicate that on the podcast because I couldn't play the music with it. And so I thought, I'd love to talk to him about that, but what else can we talk about? And then I realized a couple of weeks ago that Berklee's American Roots Music program turns 15 this year, and Matt founded that and runs it. And so I thought it'd be really cool to talk about both of those. So we sort of use the 15th anniversary as an excuse to chat about American music, but we delve into a lot of the other stuff as well. And I will stick a link to the IBMA talk in the show notes, so you can go and have a watch of the whole thing. And I really, really sort of, you know, would strongly suggest you do, because it is fascinating. I'm going to go and watch it again. Really, really cool. But that's it. Just wanted to give you a quick intro. There's so much cool stuff in this one. I really enjoyed it. I hope you do too. Here comes my chat with Matt Glazer. My guest on Bluegrass Jam Along this week is Matt Glazer. Matt was chair of the string department at Berklee College of Music for more than 25 years, and then went on to be the founder and artistic director of Berklee's American Roots Music Program, which is celebrating its 15th anniversary this year. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And first off, congratulations on 15 years of the U.S. Roots Program at Berklee.
Amazing. It's flown by.
Yeah, and it'd be really cool just to start for, I'd imagine most people listening to this are aware of Berklee, but to start with just a kind of very brief overview of why Roots Program in particular, why you felt that was needed.
Well, let's go back. I've been at Berklee for 43 years now. I've been teaching at Berklee for 43 years. And when I got there in 1981, it would have been a shameful thing that no one would have ever said to say, oh, I'm interested in bluegrass. You couldn't come out of the closet as a bluegrass musician in 1981. It was something looked down upon. And even though there were country music components in the early history of bluegrass, you know, Gary Burton, the great jazz vibraphonist, was the dean of curriculum at Berklee, and his early days were, you know, he grew up in Indiana, and his first records were done in Nashville, including a beautiful country meets jazz record called Tennessee Firebird. Do you know that record?
I don't know. I have to dig that out and have a listen.
So the Osborne Brothers are on that, Buddy Spiker, all kinds of studio musicians, as well as great jazz musicians like Roy Haynes. It's really a beautiful thing. In any case, there's always been a kind of secret history of bluegrass and country music at Berklee. The great Mike Ide was a pedal steel player. He just passed away. He was assistant chair of the guitar department, and he played the pedal steel. And Gillian Welch and David Rawlings met each other waiting in line to sign up for the country ensemble at Berklee. And now they've been together for years and made all this beautiful music. And there were famous musicians like Hiro Arita, banjo and guitar, John McGann, who died, a great, amazing mandolin and guitar player. But, you know, I was there and I taught people, and there was some folk music and bluegrass element. There were individual students. But when Roger Brown became president of Berkeley, at some point he came to me and we had a conversation, and we really recognized that there was an influx of incredible young bluegrass and related styles of music musicians. And Roger said, are we doing the best we can for these students? And out of that conversation, the American Roots Music Program was born.
And does that, just hearing you talk about it like that, it hadn't really occurred to me, but do you think maybe an element of that came out of the success of albums like Uncommon Ritual that sort of blended, you know, roots music ideas in with a more contemporary and also slightly more composed sensibility? Do you think that was maybe part of that at the same time?
Well, that, what you mentioned, but really just a large world of music that I remember when Roger Brown was auditioning to be president of Berkeley, somebody asked him in one of the interviews, what's on your iPod? And a technology that no longer exists, but people would listen to music. And on his computer, on his iPod, he listened to Bela Fleck, Alison Krauss, and then maybe Uncommon Ritual and Chris, you know, Nickel Creek. And so by the time Roger was going to be president of Berkeley, that kind of music was already at a very high, you know, there's a very different vibe between Jimmy Martin, the Stanley Brothers, Bill Monroe, and Chris Thiele, Bela Fleck, Edgar Meyer. You know, there's vast differences. So the music became more palatable for NPR listeners because it was now suddenly being played at an incredibly high level, technically, compositionally. The production values were very high. So all of those things contributed to an acceptability of music that might not have been there earlier.
And I guess, and, you know, sort of post Oh Brother, there was a vast interest in that kind of music as well. Was there any sort of sense that sort of roots music as a component of music education, like, was there any, did you get any sort of kickback from people saying, oh, this is an oral traditional music, you can't teach this? Was there any of that sort of sentiment around?
Well, what you just said makes me think of two different tracks I want to go down with you about this topic. So first, let me just say, you know, Roger came to me, and maybe initially the idea was to have a bluegrass program specifically because there were so many students interested in bluegrass. And I said, I'm not interested in running a bluegrass program because that's not, to me, my vision of a well-educated musician would be one who learns about and grasps the connections between all kinds of music in America in the first half of the 20th century. So I said, I'll run a program, and we were searching for a title, and Roots is not a particularly good title for a variety of reasons, but it's the best we could, it's better than all the other ones. You know, it's, go ahead.
I was going to say, I was looking for a definition on the website of what Roots kind of is classed as in this context. And it said the American Roots Music Program is dedicated to exploring the rural and early American music of the first half of the 20th century. And that's
a little clumsy. I didn't write those words, but let me just explicate that a little bit. I think what I said to someone who wrote those, whoever wrote that, I said, my vision of American Roots Music is all music in America up to from the dawn of the recording industry up until about 1950, and all rural music at any time. So that's what that sentence you read is trying to communicate. What I always say is what I just said to you. It doesn't fit on a bumper sticker. All music in America up until 1950, and all rural music at any time. And that intentionally broad definition allows us to look at all these different styles of music, early jazz, country blues, every kind of commercial country music including bluegrass, old time, classic country music, Western swing, Cajun music, Celtic music in America, klezmer music in America, a wide range of folk styles, earlier styles, and everything I do is Berkeley-centric. I'm not trying to reference the outer world. I know the organism that is Berkeley and the ecosystem that is Berkeley, and I'm trying to address what I see as shortcomings in the educational approach of the Berklee College of Music. And that is why I did this, because I felt that all kinds of early, and this goes back to my very earliest days at the Berklee College of Music. I remember talking to Joe Viola, a great saxophone teacher who was the chair of the woodwind department. And I said, where are the Fletcher Henderson charts? Fletcher Henderson, great early jazz band leader who employed Louis Armstrong in the 1920s briefly. Where are those charts? He said, are you kidding me? Nobody cares about that stuff around here. So the story I always tell is that at Berklee, Charlie Parker was the caveman at the dawn of time who discovered fire. That is, there's really no music of any amount that's taught at Berklee before 1945, let's say. And I'm only interested in this earlier music. I discovered something recently I realized I had to cop to it, which is I'm only interested in the music of dead people. If you're alive, I'm not interested in what you're doing. I'm interested in the music of people who are deceased. So that's my particular worldview, and I'm trying to share with students the riches that have been documented by the record companies, more power to them. The early record companies, they didn't know what they were doing, but they did succeed in recording a wide range of music in America in the first half of the 20th century. And all that music is now on everybody's phone in their pocket on YouTube. So every student, every human being on earth has instantaneous access to these incredible riches of American culture in the first half of the 20th century.
And that period is really fascinating, isn't it? Because you've got kind of field recordings of music and people going around song collecting, but also an emerging sense that this is stuff we can sell and this is an industry. And like, I've only really got my head around some of this through talking to people on the podcast about things like the Bristol Sessions or Cecil Sharp collecting songs in Appalachia or whatever, but just that sort of, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, how much of the kind of family history of American music lives in those decades. It's, you know, I knew that sort of intellectually, but just the more I go down those routes, the more you understand this sort of huge melting pot that it all comes out of.
It's so fascinating to me, this, you know, you asked me about my IBMA talk. It all came out of trying to think about what records might Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs have listened to. What particular records might they have heard that influenced their music? That to me is... That's what I wanted to focus on. Instead of more broad sociological questions about large groups of people, I'm interested in individual human musicians. Did Earl Scruggs hear a Lester Young record? Did Bill Monroe hear a Louis Armstrong record? Did Louis Armstrong hear a Bill Monroe record? Did Lester Young hear an Earl Scruggs record? It's kind of, for me, it's a thrilling mental exercise because it's very likely that those things happen that I'm asking about. You know, it's not like the record industry. Now we live in a time of this massive landscape of music and art and instantaneous access You know, I have Amazon Music on my phone. That was like 27 million recordings or something like that. It was much more limited in those days. So the chances, since there were much fewer numbers of recordings, and there were physical objects, so maybe, and they were sold in furniture stores because the early record players were like pieces of furniture. So you'd buy a nice looking wooden thing that had a record player in it. And so since they sold the record player, they also sold the records. So you can easily imagine Bill Monroe walking into a furniture store and hearing some random records of one sort or the other, or maybe hearing people play on the streets. I'm just trying to imagine an actual landscape and where this stuff happened.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because you were saying earlier on about having all the world in our phones and our pockets, and just the past few decades, talking to my son who's 11 now, and trying to impress upon him the idea that, like, when I was his age, we only had it in the UK, we had three TV stations, and so everybody watched everything. You knew all the programs, even if you didn't watch them, because that's all there was.
Wow.
And yeah. That makes no sense to him at all, because the entire world is there whenever he wants it, you know. But there was something that meant we all shared a cultural sensibility because everything was everybody's.
Amazing. Wow. So there's like BBC One, BBC Two, and then the one that's not BBC.
Yeah, so when I was a kid, there was BBC One, BBC Two, a thing called ITV, which was independent television. And then in the 80s, along came Channel 4 as this independent arty channel was a new thing. But there was like before that, there was three channels, and they weren't even on all day, you know. We'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long-time supporter of the bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small, and now by sponsoring Bluegrass Jam Along. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. With 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation has something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month, and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com.
This kind of stuff is so fascinating because I look back on my, I don't know if you saw an interview I did with Andy Statman that was up on the Mandolin Cafe website.
Yeah.
So Andy and I are, you know, we've been friends for 50 years, and he and I grew up in New York City around the same time. I mean, I think Andy's a couple of years older, but we were thinking about how we learned about music, and he told stories about going to Greenwich Village from Queens, taking the subway and carrying a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And he'd go to David Grisman's house, and Grisman would say, I got to go out for a few hours. Here are all these records. Put them on and record them. So he would sit there with this enormous machine that he had carried at great difficulty on the subway and put on Red Allen records and Osborne Brothers records and, you know, you know, Jim and Jesse records, and listen to them and record them on the reel-to-reel recording, then pack up his machine at great, it's an arduous process. It takes many hours for him to travel on the subway at great physical stress and also risk of criminal activity. Somebody could steal his tape recorder. Or for me, I would take the subway from Queens to New York City, to Manhattan, and I would go to the Record Hunter on 42nd Street and 7th Avenue and leaf through records and just look at them. And then if I would choose without hearing a note of music, I would just randomly choose a record to buy because it looked interesting that you couldn't hear it. It's not like the where you go on your phone and you can hear 30 seconds of a track before buying it for 99 cents from the comfort of your bed. You know, you go on, it takes many hours to go to the record store, leaf through. I remember one record I want to look for that I came upon was called We'll Hear Carter Stanley Sing in Heaven. There was some bluegrass record by some Virginia bluegrass band called We'll Hear Carter Stanley Sing in Heaven. I have not found any evidence of that record, but I did hold that record in my hands. So it's a physical embodied quest for musical knowledge. It's not stress-free. It's not instantaneous. You got to put on your shoes, go underground, travel for an hour, go into a store, hold the record in your hand, pay the money, go back, then put it on your record player. So it makes the music more valuable because it's not so easy to get. It makes learning about music a real commitment.
And that thing of choose it, like you put on an album and you've made one choice that lasts for maybe 40 minutes rather than choosing one song and getting bored of it halfway through and then flicking to something else because it reminded you of that. And it's just it's sort of slower decision making almost, which means you commit to the decision slightly better. But I remember all that really vividly. When I had 5 years between school and going to university, and I worked in record shops. And this, like, great, it's like, for me, it was like pulling on threads. So I was brought up on the Beatles, which is a great musical education because you've got, like, the roots of so much in there. You've got country and rockabilly, but Eleanor Rigby prepares you to hear a string quartet, you know.
Yes.
There's so many. I've Just Seen a Face, prepares you to hear bluegrass. And so just pulling on some of those threads and hearing things and hearing, like, American music and going, well, hang on a minute, because this was in a record store, and going, hey, I've got this record here that is Hank Williams, and that belongs in the section that we call country. And then we've got this record here by Louis Jordan, which doesn't sound all that different to me, but that goes in jazz. And then we've got this record here that's kind of, you know, Elvis Presley, whoever, and that belongs in rock and roll. But they sound like basically the same thematic material to me.
Harmonically,
all the chords are full of sixths, and they're not straight blues, but they're not straight jazz, and they're not, you know, with varying degrees of swing, they're essentially the same music.
This is so important what you're saying. It's so incredibly important. Just before I go on, I want to say, you know, the great John McGann, who taught mandolin at Berkeley and passed away, he learned music through the Beatles. He learned every track, every part of every track of every Beatles song. And we would play a game on gigs. People would shout out the name of any Beatles song, and he could play every instrument's part and sing every part of the song. So his textbook for how to learn music was to just learn every part of every track of every Beatles song.
I
like what you know, I like that. I know from knowing John that this is an incredibly great way to learn about music. But getting back to your second point, you know, the record companies did amazing things, but they were also these commercial entities trying to make money, and they made decisions that have warped the view of the music. They made decisions for economic reasons. You know, so the famous story that they wanted to market records to black people, so they recorded music they thought black people would buy, and they called that race records. They wanted to market music to poor white people in America, so they recorded music they thought poor white people would like and called that hillbilly music. And many of the great early blues what we think of as blues musicians were like vast musicians who played a wide range of things. They were musicians. They wanted to make a living, so they learned music that people would pay to hear. But the record companies said, no, you're black, we want, and you play some blues, we just want you to record the blues because we've made a decision that we can market that to black audiences. So those decisions by the record companies actually changed the way music in black communities was performed, because before that, the banjo might have been a more prominent instrument. But since they didn't document black banjo styles, they just documented black guitar styles. So then people were like, oh, we're going to buy our kid a guitar because we only hear guitar records being played by black musicians. And you see how the economic, and then they became, record stores existed and they had to put things in bins. And this goes to your exact point. So someone makes a decision, not entirely for musical reasons, for reasons that may be economic or cultural or strategic or who knows what. We're going to put this bin and we're going to put so-and-so in this bin, and something else that might be very similar goes in a different bin.
Yeah, and I wonder whether that, because particularly in the earlier days of recorded music, you would get the same song recorded in each of those genres by a different artist, and there wasn't that encouragement of artists to cross over the lines in the way that, like, people now want their artists to appeal to everybody. But you'd have the same song maybe sung by somebody different for the hillbilly market, somebody different for the race market, somebody, you know, and that was the approach, wasn't it, to keep people in their lanes almost.
Well, it's interesting. I did a talk about the song Frankie and Johnny. So Frankie and Johnny is a song that's based in a true event that happened where a woman named Frankie Baker killed her, you know, her boyfriend came at her with a knife, and she had a gun, as they said at that time, everybody had a gun in those days, and she shot him, and she was quickly exonerated for killing this guy in self-defense. And it was in the black part of St. Louis, and quickly a black songwriter wrote a song about it, but that song was lost in the mists of time, and then a white songwriter wrote it, and then the song was covered and developed in many communities and many styles of music. And it's probably the most, I think the last time I checked, I had 400 versions on my computer of Frankie and Johnny in every conceivable style of music across decades, early jazz, tons of country blues, in country music, in Western swing, in pop music of all sorts, all through, up through the present day. So you can do like a history of American music through the prism of this one song. But then again, if it's the same song, and this, it's clearly the same song, it's like, are there really all these different styles if people are doing the same song in America? It's like the American song. It tells this American story that everybody wanted to tell. And there are differences stylistically, but not so dramatic that you would say, oh, that's completely different. It's not like a Mahler symphony treatment of Frankie and Johnny. You know, they're all kind of similar. So my view, it may not be true, but I'm trying to look at all of American music as one thing. I may be on a fool's errand. It's not, I don't know, but I'm enjoying the process of trying to view this music as one thing, or at least to look at the deep similarities between style, the musical similarities between these various styles.
Yeah, and that
and
was
then the worst thing that would happen. The worst thing that would happen educationally, if you do it that way, is that people get an education in a wider range of styles of music in America.
Yeah, I think we get too fixed with the idea of being right with stuff. Like, it doesn't matter if you're right; it takes you on an interesting journey, and in finding out that you're slightly wrong, you learn something. That's why I bought this book. Where
I love this. I love that. That's right.
And I bought myself a book that lists a piece of classical music for every day of the year, and there's a page written about it, and you listen to your piece. And I thought, like, my first impulse was like, oh, but what if I don't listen to them all? And it's like, but even if you don't, you'd probably still listen to 250 pieces of music you wouldn't have done otherwise. Like, even if you, quote-unquote, fail to finish, you know, it's like, it's nonsense, isn't it?
That's so great, yeah. By failing, you've gotten much farther than if you didn't undertake any of this journey at all. So you wanted to talk a little bit about music education. So what you said, there's a difference in musical education in Britain between the United States. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know if there is, but again, it's one of those things that in not being right, we might learn something. But I did a music degree in the 90s. And at that time, I finished school and I wanted to go to university, but I didn't want to do an English degree or anything that. And I looked for music degrees to do that weren't classical degrees. And there was one at the University of Surrey that taught you to be something called a Tonmeister, which is like a classical recording engineer, which wasn't for me. There was too much maths. There was like classical courses, but there wasn't really anything that would allow you to study music in a popular form. And I think my sort of theory is that because classical music is such a European thing, that's kind of our tradition, but particularly being English, I don't know that English people really know what their roots music is anyway, because we have generally not had to guard our culture against people coming to try and take it away from us. But all of that comes together. There's also an element of snobbery about popular music not being proper. And I just wonder whether, and it's probably different now, there probably are other courses, but I did a 3-year degree in popular music studies. It was in part academic, was in part performance, in part composition. And I had a great time surrounded by musicians with, you know, time and studios. But we had a visiting professor from Berkeley who came for a term called Stephen Weber. And I was fascinated at the idea of what his perception of this weird little rural artsy college in the UK was compared to something like Berkeley. And it just felt like the UK was so behind the curve in terms of being prepared to teach popular music as a proper thing, if that makes sense.
Stephen Weber is a good friend of mine. I've known him for many years. And he, you know, he plays the banjo and is a recording engineer and also a turntablist and a very wide range of things. So, you know, I personally am very interested in all kinds of music that people look down their nose at. I've always been, and to me, the self-evident musical value of these folk styles, indigenous music styles, vernacular music styles, folk music, whatever, popular music styles. I mean, I think the value of these musical styles is self-evident to me. And in any case, I'm interested in these things and I want to study them. I wrote my master's thesis on Texas style fiddling and I got into it. You know, it came about because I was getting a graduate degree at Tufts and I had to write a thesis in ethnomusicology. And one night I went out to dinner. Mark O'Connor and I were playing twin fiddles with David Grisman's quintet at Carnegie Hall with Yo-Yo Ma on Stephen Grappelli's 80th birthday party. Yeah. And the night before the gig, Mark O'Connor and I went out to dinner and, you know, he's this master contest fiddler. And I talked to him about contest fiddling and I thought, okay, I'm just going to do this thing because it's a style of fiddle playing that is evidently incredibly highly evolved, but there's no verbal component to it. There's not like a bunch of eggheads like me saying a lot of words about it. But does the absence of words about music reflect poorly on the music? No, the music is the music. And there may just, maybe in certain cultures, there's just not a tradition of words about music. You know, and so I think that there's all kinds of styles of music on earth that don't have academic, wordy, intellectual component that goes along with it. And the music itself is still unbelievable and deep and communicates one human being to another on a high level artistically through the music itself. If nobody had written a word about Bach, would that in any way take one eyelash away from Bach's achievement? It would not. although you could say that all of these words deepen our appreciation of how great Bach is, but the music, Bach wrote all that music and he died. And it's all there. And now to this day, people are still unearthing, seeing in it how much there is in it. But they're not putting it into the Bach. They're discovering it in the Bach. So I feel like that's what popular music studies are doing. They're not putting value into the music. They're discovering the value that's in the music and expressing it through words.
Yeah, and that's a lovely way of putting it. And it's, and I might be wrong about this, but in my head, I'm sure I've read somewhere that Bach was totally forgotten for a long time. And it was only in the sort of 60s that a bunch of people got interested in what's this old music. And, you know.
Yeah, yeah. His kids were like, oh, yeah, that's dad's old shit. You know, that's there was a feeling of like, oh, that's so passé.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the Baroque stuff just disappeared until the 60s, and people started digging it out and looking for scores and recording it. And, you know, and we look at it now, it's always been there and it's always been venerated. And I don't think it has.
No, like Pablo Casals discovered the Bach cello suites in a music store that his music had not been found. And I mean, earlier than that, Mendelssohn, and around that time, there was a rediscovery of Bach.
And it's just really interesting, sort of as a kind of been at music college in the UK, and looking across the pond, because you read the magazines and people, you know, Berkeley was being written about, and the idea that a college could produce two musicians that I loved, two of many musicians I love, but two in particular, like Gillian Welch, and on the other hand, like Will Calhoun, the drummer of Living Colour, who operate in very different spheres, but it just, the sense that those things are equally valuable and that you can teach somebody for as long as you like about music, but they can still come out with that absolute, like, you, I think in the UK, somebody having been taught at music college for 3 years, people would somehow consider that as being slightly like disingenuous, if you know what I mean. Like, there's no more authentic, real, heartfelt, soulful, rootsy music in the world than Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings. And I found that idea fascinating, because I think British people struggle with that sometimes.
Well, I don't know. I frankly, and I haven't talked to her about this, nor have I read an interview, I don't know what she got out of going to Berkeley. One thing I can say is that for a lot of people I've worked with, we can hope that nothing I did harmed them. You know, I don't think I did anything that harmed them in any way, but I can't say with certainty that anything I did helped them absolutely. It's like a city of music, Berkeley, and you get all these things and you get all these experiences, and hopefully the experiences you have are positive and help you in a variety of ways.
Yeah, and it was interesting reading. I mean, that very much my experience of being at university studying music was that the being surrounded by music and by people who loved music was a massive thing.
And that's just always being part, the main thing, yeah. That's
being
so
part
great.
Of that ecosystem was wonderful. Yeah. I love that. So that on the Berkeley website, it says Berkeley's mission is to educate, train, and develop students to excel in music as a career. And I would find that interesting, that it is, like, regardless of whether people go down a deep dive. I heard you talking in an interview at some point about specialization first versus kind of broader skill sets. And I think the examples you gave were Jenna Moynihan and Bronwyn Keith Hines, and how you can just go right down a specialist route or be broader, and they're both equally valid things. But this overarching thing is the idea that you are preparing musicians to go and do something with that. It's not just a navel gazing exercise. It's a sort of a part of the arc of working out who they are and how they want to go out into the world with that.
Well, you know, I guess I have to cop to my own. I feel like for 43 years, I've been an outlier at Berkeley. I don't feel that my views fit comfortably into Berkeley ecosystem. I've managed to continue to work there and be successful in my own little area. But I personally, and I could get in trouble for saying this. I personally have not focused on helping students have a career. The reason I've never been focused on that is the goalposts are constantly being moved in the business of music.
Yeah.
You know, for one example would be the geniuses of the music industry tried to predict what would come after the LP and the CD. Now the CD's gone, and then they tried streaming, and you know, we're always one step behind in trying to predict things or how to monetize these things or not monetize them, or whether or not it's even possible to make a living as a musician. I don't want to encourage people to spend their life chasing after something that they'd be unable to even predict. Nobody is able to predict accurately what's going to happen. But I do believe in a lifetime commitment to the path of being a musician, to learning about music as a lifetime's work. That may intersect at times with the profession. It may not at times, but, you know, having as a center of your being this life of being a musician and the healing power of learning about music and the healing power of music itself, and that you'll never learn as much as you want to learn about music before you die, so that you might as well just realize that every single day you've got to learn about it, because you can say with absolute certainty you're going to be on your deathbed and there's going to be so much about music that you never learned about, that you wish you had learned about. So what are we doing, you know, trying to prepare people? I mean, and that people get angry at me for saying things like this, like, because then why would you be spending all that money to go to college? I understand why Berkeley frames it this way, because a college education is very expensive, and you want to be able to say, oh yeah, if you come to Berkeley, we'll help you get a career. And maybe that's true, and I hope that's true for the most of Berkeley students. But I can say that our little area, the American Roots Music Program, incredibly high percentage of those students are working as they have good careers. So even though I'm not trying to do that, it's ended up with the same result. You know, when you look at a bluegrass festival flyer in the United States, 90% of the people who are below 40 years old playing on festivals went to Berkeley. That's how domineering we are in this. There is no style of music that Berkeley dominates as much as Berkeley now dominates bluegrass. And that's a bit so wild for me to get my head around. But, you know, Molly Tuttle, her band is four-fifths Berkeley. Sierra Hull, her band is three-fifths Berkeley. Sam Grisman, you know, all these. Just I go on and on and on and on, and so many people came through Berkeley who are now making a living as touring bluegrass musicians. Now, maybe they would say Berkeley had nothing to do with it, or I wish I hadn't gone to that damn place, or it was the greatest thing and greatest experience I ever had. I have no idea. But the facts are that we dominate this style of music in a way that Berkeley does not dominate any other style of music.
Well, and maybe it does speak a little bit to that thing we were just talking about just surrounding yourself with stuff. Like, if your job as an artist is to most fully realize you, not like somebody else, but you, because you're the only you that can ever be, and you spend 3 years being dragged in different directions and trying things. Like, you know, when I was at university, I got dragged into, you know, produce an electronic dance music single. God knows why, but I did. And you get these opportunities and it drags you, and you come through that with a sense of, like, what you are as an artist and as a musician, and like the people who have a really strong sense of who they are and a really strong musical identity, I guess, are very employable people, because you're getting. So there's a really famous, I'm sure you're not famous, but a saying that I love. And I think, who was it? I think it might have been Craig Habighurst, who said, personnel is personality. And the idea that the people that are making art are what give the art the personality. And so if you've got a bunch of people who've fully realized what their path and their journey is and they know who they are, why wouldn't you want to employ them?
I mean, a lot of these kids have amazing chops. You know, their technique is unbelievable. And that's become part of the world that we live in, this high level of technical skill. That's not my particular interest, but that's a fact of the world that we live in, you know. Like bluegrass in its early days, you know, bluegrass in its early days is not dominated by individuals with chops as a main thing. You know, they're like somehow differently, like the Stanley Brothers and Jimmy Martin and Bill Monroe. And we don't think of these people as technical wizards of the highest point, although maybe Earl Scruggs is getting close to that level of, but they, like you say earlier, like their personality, they're fully formed artists, whatever they are, they're incredibly fully formed personal artists.
Yeah, and I mean, it maybe ties back to that point you made about Bach, about like just he poured himself into the stuff that he did, and so that stuff is still with us. And he, as a character, and it was, you know, he's still with us as a result of it. I was talking to Bill Amott about Tony Rice the other day, and just it doesn't like Tony's music is still here and is still an extraordinary thing, but it sort of feels like Tony Rice is still a presence in the world. Like almost a physical, developing, growing presence because of all that. And, you know, that might sound slightly over the top, but it sort of feels true that...
That's something I always say. Like, I say, Kenny G's body is alive, but his music is dead. Louis Armstrong's music is alive, but his body is dead. You know, so, or Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's body is dead, but his music is alive. So do you want someone who... You don't give someone credit just for the accident of biological processes still going on, you know, whereas you're absolutely right. Tony Rice is a living thing, even though his body is no longer here. His music is very alive. People are developing stuff from what he did. It's very living.
Yeah, this is probably like a massive tangent, but it feels related to me. I don't know if you're aware of the Harry Potter books and films, but there's this element in there where the kind of the arch villain of Harry Potter world splits his soul and puts it into a bunch of individual objects with the idea that to actually kill him, you'd have to destroy all these objects. You'd have to hunt them all down and destroy them. And it's like, but essentially that's what an artist does. You put a bit of your soul into everything you do. And then that bit of your soul lives for as long as people play those recordings or sing those songs or play that music. Or when you teach, I'm sure like all your students that have gone through Berklee, a little bit of the soul of the people teaching them is imparted into them and it carries on. And that's what art is, isn't it? It's giving away a little bit of yourself constantly in the hope that that bit of you continues living in wherever it lands, you know.
Yeah, my wife has read the Harry Potter books, but I haven't. So, but maybe now I need to go back. And, but I mean, for me, I'm trying to not put my soul into people I teach, but the soul of Louis Armstrong, Lester Young, Earl Scruggs, whoever. You know, I want them. I believe in these musicians and believe in what they did and they left. Billie Holiday, you know, I mean, on and on, people. And these people who have left us this great art, all of this these recordings, which are, you know, I mean, I was just thinking the other day, like, there's a record of Billie Holiday doing A Sailboat in the Moonlight with Lester Young on tenor sax. And I've listened to that record thousands of times in my life, and each time, there's something new and fresh in it that I discover or changes my state in some way. So I really believe in this music, and I believe in the, you know, one thing I want to say about this talk that I gave at IBMA is I'm really sick of words about music. So I wanted to play as much music as I could get away with and still make some points verbally. So I tried to do something different than people often do. I didn't want a guy talking about music. As much as this is fun and wonderful to talk with you about music, I'm like, where's the music? I want to hear the actual music. There's so much music I could play or to illustrate points. And that's why I had to then cut down a lot of tracks. And I just had to find a few seconds so that I could find a little clip that would, as soon as I put on the clip, we're in music universe and the music sounds so great. Even if it's only 5 seconds of the music, Earl Scruggs playing doop dee doop dee doop dee doop dee doop dee doop. It sounds, all you need to hear is 7 seconds of that, and you're in Earl Scruggs's universe, swinging, playing this syncopated rhythm, and then you can then find another 7 seconds from somebody else, and you're in this universe of music without me just telling you about it. I'm so sick of people talking about music or writing about music. It's music. I want to hear the music. So this is my gripe right now. And if I'm going to do, I try to keep my iPad with me wherever I go, because I might go into my boss's office at Berkeley and say, hey, listen to this. I want to be that guy. I want to be the guy who comes into your office and plays you some shit, because otherwise it's just a lot of words.
And it's so funny you say that, because I was in the room for that IBMA keynote speech, and I'll put a link in the show notes because it's on Facebook. People can go and watch it
I'll send you the link. We put it up on YouTube, a much better clip on YouTube. So I'll send you the YouTube link, where I prefer people look at it there. You were in the room when I gave the talk?
I was in the room, and I remember it was the first time I've been to IBMA, and it was the first day of the first time I've been to IBMA, and seeing, keynote talk. Okay, well, let's go and see what this is about. And I remember turning to the guy I was sat with and just saying, this is fascinating subject matter, but I'm actually just really enjoying hearing these songs over a big system in a big room. They sound so good.
Yeah, they sound fucking great. I was amazed. And it's, I just made these clips with my work study students on my iPad, and I was so nervous. I alluded to this, and my hand was shaking a couple of times. I couldn't even press the button to play the track. That was the only problem I had in a couple of times. I had to grab my own finger like Dr. Strangelove and put my finger on the track to get it to play. But yeah, I had the same response as you did in the hall. Like, wow, this music sounds awesome. And to listen to this music all together with people, all of whom knew the music already, like, by and large, people knew almost all the tracks, or they were reminded. Like when I played that Bill Monroe solo on Prisoner's song, I could tell people were like, oh man, I haven't listened to that track in a long time. That is a killing solo. It was really fun to have people like, oh yeah, I know this, and listen together.
And my memory of it was like, on the night, there were a couple of those clips that sort of got a spontaneous round of applause from people.
Yes, exactly. Somebody's clapping for a little iTunes clip.
And it's so funny, we were talking earlier, like...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, we were talking earlier about, whether the jazz players had heard the bluegrass players and whether the opposite was true. And I interviewed Tony Trischka earlier this year because it was Earl Scruggs' 100th birthday. And I collected together various people to talk about Earl and his legacy. And Tony was saying, we talked about specifically the solos on Don't Get Above Your Raising with that lovely octave thing, but also Heavy Traffic Ahead. And he said that Earl once described that to him as his boogie woogie banjo.
Boogie, yeah. And Tony, Tony and I were roommates in the 1970s in 202 Riverside Drive when Bela Fleck came for banjo lessons. He was like 16 years old. And Tony was the one who told me, I alluded to this in the talk, although I didn't mention Tony by name, the idea that Earl Scruggs or Bill Monroe heard Blind Boy Fuller playing Heavy Traffic Ahead or something very similar to that. And so those guys knew their music was rooted in this popular black music that they really loved, and there were elements of those. You know, and I really make a point in the IBMA talk of comparing, and I think I'm the first person to do this, comparing the groove in Earl Scruggs's right hand to the groove in the great boogie-woogie pianist Pete Johnson. Mm. Like, that's what I'm really interested in. That's where the rubber meets the road. Like, if you know the music, you should be able to hear these things. So I'm not impressed by a lot of words about shit sociologically or whatever. I want people who've really listened to music deeply.
And it is
perhaps
amazing.
Perhaps we can end on that note.
Yeah, and that just
is there anything else you wanted to wrap up with?
No, and I think that's a lovely place to end, just that sentiment of how much there still is to get out of just listening to this stuff that's been around for a century already.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
Bluegrass Jamalong is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.